From WXXI News, this is the Summer of Food on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this hour was made in a kitchen where a local mother of three was exploring her passion. Not only was Rudy Harris preparing summer meals for people in our community, she was launching a new career. Rudy is one of 12 fellows who are part of a new program at FoodLink, where they receive a full year of classes and hands-on training to help them prepare for careers in the regional food industry. And for someone like Rudy who says, quote, food is my everything, well, it's a perfect fit. And the food industry today is seeing a high demand for workers like Rudy at the middle skills level. And nonprofits like FoodLink are working to close that gap. And this hour, we're talking about the role the industry can play in helping to reduce food insecurity while also serving as an economic engine for the community and pulling people out of poverty. It was Mitch Gruber who told us not too long ago that you were still to meet someone in the food industry, restaurant scene and elsewhere. They were saying, well, we got enough jobs. We don't need any people. So Mitch is back here from FoodLink, Chief Programs Officer, member of Rochester City Council, and you're still hearing that about the need, aren't you?
Yeah, just to reiterate that what we're hearing is that there's a need for people.
Absolutely.
Yeah, the jobs.
No one is saying we have no need for any people anymore.
Right.
We're good. We're full.
And the industry is thriving, as I'm sure John will tell us.
All right, very good. Well, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having us.
And John, who we mentioned, is John Emerson, chef and vice president of restaurant foods at Wegmans Food Markets. We used to call it prepared foods. Nice to have you here, John. Thanks for being here.
Thanks, Evan.
Also with us is Rudy, who we mentioned. LaRonda Rudy Harris is a member of the inaugural class that we just talked about. Rudy, thank you for being here. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you. And Jess Scannell Rooks is director of career empowerment initiatives at FoodLink. Jess, welcome to you, too.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
Before we get Rudy's story, Mitch, we ought to talk about why you developed this program to begin with. And need is one thing, but need means a lot of different things, a lot of different kinds of needs. So take me through the reason that you're deciding to do something like this.
Sure. Just a little bit of context, and then I'll really pass it off to John. But a couple years ago, FoodLink, we started working on our new community kitchen, which is a 28,000 square foot facility inside of our Mount Reed Boulevard warehouse. And Wegmans was one of the key partners in terms of not just funding it, but also helping us design it, helping us scale for the future. And John and some of his colleagues from Wegmans were really encouraging us to think about workforce development as a key component. Our kitchen produces about 5,000 hot meals a day to after-school feeding programs, other, you know, charter schools, so on and so forth. But we realized very clearly in the process that we needed to also scale up for the opportunity to train folks, because partners like Wegmans had this immense need. And I'll let John talk about that, but that's really the context that brought us here.
Okay, John?
Great. Yeah, I was 2 years ago, as Mitch said, I was on this middle skills development team. And we were spending a lot of time in high schools and colleges looking at some of the culinary training and some of the amazing programs here, like East High School, the OASIS program, MCC, and FLCC. But one thing that I saw was you come out of these programs knowing a lot, but you didn't get a lot of practice. And I went back to my youth. In 1988, I did an apprenticeship. For 3 years, I worked on the job amongst senior cooks and experienced people, and I learned the theory of how to bone out a chicken, let's say, but I got thousands and thousands of chickens to practice on. So it really created a difference between knowledge and applied skills. And I like to think of it as, rather than just having the credentials to get a job, it gave me the skills to get my first year performance review, all A's. And that helped me grow in my career. And so we think there's an opportunity there. And, you know, working for Wegmans, and we employ thousands of culinarians throughout our company, it's always such a struggle to find people that have those skills. Some people have a little part of it, but not very well-rounded. Some people have a lot of knowledge, like I do. I tell my cooks on my team all the time, I could tell you how to drive a nail into a piece of wood and countersink it. I could never make a living framing a house. I'd be on my first wall when they were done the block. And cooking's kind of the same way. So we started working with FoodLink, looking at their kitchen. They wanted some help, and we've always had a strong partnership with FoodLink. And we thought, wow, they're making thousands of meals a day, nourishing the community. They could nourish our community with great training if we got them tied in with the right curriculum and course. What a tremendous opportunity. And we started to collaborate, and then Jess joined the team. And 2 years later, we started a program a week ago, didn't we?
Yeah, it's been a really amazing ride. After Wegmans kind of explained what the need was, and then we did a little bit of quantifying as well. MCC has done a lot of research on what the growing needs are economically in our community, and it's clear that there will be more jobs in the hospitality industry and food industry. Obviously, the Finger Lakes REDC, the Economic Development Council, they've identified food as one of the key pillars of our region. And yet the training programs that exist in our community were not training for the middle skills. So once John made this clear, MCC corroborated. What we did at FoodLink was we started to fundraise for the program and eventually hired Jess, who has an immense amount of experience not just running, but also designing programs like this across the country. And we're really fortunate to have her. And I do just want to make mention, and I'll probably mention it again because it's incredibly important. We really, other than the industry partnerships like Wegmans and Ledestri and Barilla and Palmer Foods and U of R, I could go on and on. Three foundations stepped up to the plate to get this thing funded. And we'll talk about what that funding goes towards eventually, which is really a job for people like Rudy. But those were the William McGowan Foundation, the William Sheila Konar Foundation, and the ESL Foundation. And the three of those stepped up to the plate. They took a chance. They funded this. They gave Jess and her team a chance to design the program. And now we're started on July 9th. It's pretty amazing.
By the way, Mitch, just last hour we had a congressional candidate on who talked about industry in Western New York and identified farming as underutilized and food and farming as misunderstood as to the scale of opportunity. And I think some of our listeners who don't work in food and farming may be surprised at that. Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, farming's particularly challenging, especially, I mean, we talk about an industry with significant labor shortages. I mean, we have some real significant issues with farming, but the food industry touches everything. I mean, the folks around the table, obviously Wegmans is a unique partner here, but we also think about what the U of R has in terms of cafeterias in their different residence halls, but then also the hospital systems that they run. I mean, every big institution has a level of food service, and these are not typically minimum wage jobs. There's middle skills jobs available in those industries, and this is the first such program that builds people towards a pathway in those careers.
You think about all the skills, and we're going to talk about Rudy and developing those skills in just a second, but John mentioned just what, deboning a chicken? So I took a knife skills class, and we got to the chicken at the end, and I remember wishing that we had spent more time in it, because like you on framing out a house, I could do it. I'm not going to be very quick. And it just occurred to me, even just kind of dealing with deboning a chicken, how skilled you have to be to do it well, to do it fast, to do it without waste. And how much work did it take for you to before you finally were comfortable enough to say, yep, I can do this efficiently?
Great question. And chicken's just one thing.
I'm sure you can think of even more complicated
ones. On top of making sure I get a good yield on the chicken, that it's going to taste good, I keep it good, I've got to keep it safe. I take inventory on my fingers at the end of each shift as well.
Yeah.
You know, we've got to be able to work safely and protect ourselves and other people. There's so many skills that go into a kitchen, and the requirements to work in the food industry are only getting bigger. Culinarians are needed to know much more about nutrition now, about food safety. We know a lot more about pathogens now than we did when I was an apprentice. So there's a lot of learning, a lot of room for the school class, but learning how to bone a chicken, I think you get it. You start getting it right around number 1,000.
Something like that, right?
Something like that. And it's like that with a lot of jobs. And we need to make sure that when we're learning skills versus just learning knowledge about something, we do a lot of repetition so that you get really good at it. There's different plateaus that you go through in learning a trade, I think. One being semi-competent, one being good enough to show other people. But even then, you're limited if you want to compare it to your income. How much food can you cook in a day? That's a direct relationship to how much you're worth. And then, as you grow your knowledge and your skills and you can teach them to others, now you're worth as much as that team can produce, and so on and so forth as you grow your career. So the foundation starts with that one thing and learning how to do it really well every time.
I see all of your fingers, I think.
Yes.
All 10.
I'm holding up 10.
I can confirm.
Yes. Jess Cantle-Ruxa, if this program is successful, you've got fellows like Rudy who, what's the vision that you have for the future of people like Rudy?
Well, I want Rudy to be able to realize her career dreams. and to be able to support her family in a way that she feels comfortable doing it, and to be able to open doors and pathways for other folks like her.
You got 12 fellows in the inaugural class here, and I assume, Mitch, Jess, that's a function of resources. I mean, are there goals to grow? What's long-term here? What are you looking at for this kind of a program? And you want to take that, Jess?
Yeah, sure. We're looking to, once we've proven the model, so to speak, to enroll a new class of 12 to 16 every quarter.
Every quarter.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there is something to the fact that we want them to be small cohorts. We want people to have, again, part of this is it's the on-the-job training. We want people to be participatory in our kitchen. But we would like to be at a point where we have multiple cohorts going per year. And that will be a question of resources. But we really believe that what we learn this first year will set the table for the future.
Jess, where's this all happening?
Where is the program happening? Yeah. At FoodLink, at our community
kitchen. I think some people are constantly surprised at what you have there, the resource that you have.
I bet some of your listeners are surprised to think that this training program, folks at FoodLink are cooking food using fresh chicken, potentially, because oftentimes people think of a food bank as using canned product.
Yep.
But that's not the case. We just had... We have lunch together at the Career Fellowship. We all break bread together, and we just had a delicious kale salad right before coming over here. So we use fresh product, and that's what our fellows practice their craft with.
The worst time to host a radio show is 12 to 2. You can get no normal lunch hour. You either eat early or really late. And you can tell on days where I get ornery at about 1:30 when I'm hosting the show. I probably haven't eaten lunch yet. So thanks a lot for telling me what you just had for lunch. And I'm going to turn to Rudy. LaRonda Rudy Harris is a member of this inaugural class. And I know we've used that phrase, food is your everything. What's that mean for you? Why do you say that?
Because I always wanted to work with food.
You've always wanted to work with food?
Yes.
So what are your memories of food growing up?
Watching my grandma cook. And just learning different things and how to make different foods.
Did you have any favorites or things that really fascinated you when you were growing
up? My favorite food is pork chops. And that's what I like.
What is your dream in food, Rudy?
My dream in food is to teach everyone different and how to make different dishes for everyone to love.
Do you want to work in food? You want to have a job in the food industry?
Yes.
Okay. And so where would that be? What's 5 years, 10 years from now? If things are going how you want, where are you?
I might own my own restaurant.
I like that idea. What's the biggest challenge? What do you want to learn from this program?
What I want to learn from this program? I want to learn how to show my kids different and to, I don't know.
Okay, well, I mean, because everybody comes in with different skills. So for you, what's the skill that you really want to acquire and strengthen?
I want to learn how to work with food better. And I want to be able to learn how to use a knife better.
I couldn't agree more. That's exactly what I was thinking about that knife skills class I took, because I think John said it so well. You can become proficient at something, but are you good enough to do it at a work skills level? And you watch people who are really trained with knife skills,
mm-hmm.
They're flying, aren't they? I mean, the way
yes.
they, what they can cut. How's your knife skill right now?
It's okay, but not too perfect. I want to be perfect at what I do. I don't want to be half off. I just want to be perfect.
Let me see those fingers. You got them all. That's what I was thinking in knife skills, Rudy, is number one, don't lose a digit.
Mm-hmm.
Keep all your fingers and toes.
Right.
How much practice do you think you're going to need? I mean, when you think about how much work that's going to be, John talked about maybe doing 1,000 chickens before he felt, I mean, proficient at another level.
Once I learn how to do something, somebody tell me once, I got it. But if it's wrong, I try to fix it.
And one of the exciting things about this program, too, is the specific curriculum we're using. I mean, I give Jess and our colleagues at FoodLink, but also some of John's associates at Wegmans really helped to develop a curriculum. But on top of that, we're using a national model called Ruby, which actually is an online format, which I'll let Jess talk about more. And yeah, it's true. I'm confident that someone like Rudy doesn't need to see things more than once to learn it or to understand it. But the purpose of Ruby is to give people this platform to be able to do it consistently and then use the same skill set in our kitchen while we're preparing 5,000 meals a day. I don't know if you want to talk about, if you want to mention any features to Ruby.
Well, Ruby is, like Mitch said, it's a web-based curriculum, and it's something that folks can watch videos on. They can interact with a live support and another chef on the other end. But then they also go into the kitchen and they're live graded by our executive chef so that they get the opportunity to learn a skill and then immediately after a quick break get in and practice it. And then have our staff who have also been trained on Ruby mentor them and then eventually evaluate their skills.
And so a typical day for you, Rudy, has been like what? I mean, I know you just started like a week ago, just a week and a half ago. But what's a typical day been like for you?
Good. It's been great. You know, you could just go there and just do what you gotta do and go home.
And I'm reading that one of the things you like doing is working with the cold room and the kitchen's cold room.
Yes.
What's that?
It's like a cooler. Like they do the lunches. So we pack the lunches different, put different stuff in the trays. So it's fun, but it's cold.
it's cold. Only
your hands.
Only your hands?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a really interesting point. What we had, so Wegmans is obviously a key partner, but another key partner in this program was Palmer Foods. And we had Kip Palmer in the door about a year ago when we were planning this. And one of the things that Kip said was that temperature control or temperature and the differences in environment are really one of the things that help people stay on the job for a long time. A lot of times in the food industry, you're working in a freezer, you're working in a cooler, you're working in a really hot kitchen. And one thing that Kip said was if you can give people the experience that, and they know that they need to prepare themselves for not working in ideal temperature controls every moment of the day, they'll have a better chance for success. So getting folks into the cold room, getting them, have we gotten in the freezer yet?
Mm-hmm.
Getting people ready to spend some time in the freezer, taking inventory. Those are key skills. And fortunately, we have the resources to get people that practice.
All right. Well, that's good stuff. And what kind of meals have you been preparing so far, Rudy?
We didn't really prepare meals. But it's like we just do the trays. Like, we put bread, mm-hmm. carrots in a tray, and then we stack them on the shelves. And then they take those inside the cold room.
Very good. Jess, can you tell us a little bit more about what the kind of an average day is going to look like for your 12 fellows?
Sure. We 3 days a week, we start immediately in the kitchen. So there's a morning meeting with our executive chef where he lays out the plan for the day. And then our fellows immediately go into the kitchen. They work through whatever process we have for that day. So whatever meals we're preparing, we usually prepare a day in advance. And fellows on those days end with the Ruby training in our computer lab. And then 2 days a week, we start with soft skills class. And at our first break, our fellows get to go back into the kitchen and practice some of those soft skills. So one of the benefits of having a year-long program is that we get to work together with our fellows to address any of the barriers that might keep them from having not only getting a job but sustaining a job.
By the way, the spelling for Ruby is R-O-U-X-B-E. That has to be clever.
Get me started on that one.
You don't like it?
No.
I like it.
Yeah,
it's
no,
clever.
It's good. It's,
who gets credit for it?
There's a company that they have been incredibly supportive. Is the company called Ruby?
It
I
is.
Presume
it is.
John, let our listeners know what a roux is, R-O-U-X.
Well, a roux is a blend of fat and flour used to thicken a sauce.
I love that. So I think that's very clever. It's a great name.
And it's a curriculum that a lot of big national employers are using, mm-hmm. Wegmans being one, but who are some of the other ones as well?
I think Marriott International uses it, a number of large organizations. At Wegmans, we started testing it a few years back, and we use it for a number of our entry-level culinarians now to help get them up to another level. And then we have an additional two-year culinary management training program that graduates of the Ruby program can go on to and become a sous chef, a management-level culinarian in our stores.
So the 12 fellows who are doing this right now are going to have different paths and different outcomes. What's an example of, pick three or four different jobs you could see down the line that you're going to say, hey, you know, John, our fellows are, someone is here doing this and someone's here doing this. Well, what are the kind of jobs that you see out of
Sure. No doubt many of them are going to find a job with Wegmans, hopefully, or one of our restaurants or some of the other great restaurants around town. Some may go off into food manufacturing with a company like La Destri or Barilla, or some could be food stylists working for magazines or marketing firms. Rudy, you could be a private chef on a yacht for some affluent corporation or family. People are going to go off, and as you go through your career, you're going to find the things that you're passionate about. You may go back to school and become a nutritionist because you're so excited about food and helping people live healthier, better lives. Some people will learn to manage the business of food. It's really a platform or a springboard that you can go almost any direction. I spend more time in an office now, but I could go in a kitchen if I had to. You can just go on to so many different things.
And I think institutional and commercial kitchens are going to be a really big opportunity. Again, our two biggest employers in town are the hospital systems. There's lots and lots of food being served at those institutions, and I think we're preparing people for the ability to cook in large batch as well. Again, our kitchen does 5,000 meals a day. The other piece, just to piggyback on what John said about manufacturing, the third element to our kitchen, the first is the meal production, the second is this fellowship, but the third is that we also slice apples. We're doing really, it's actually pretty significant manufacturing. It's fresh cut, but it is mostly automated, and we've had some of the big food manufacturing companies in town come through our facility and look at it and say, yeah, you know, the skill sets you would learn on the line in our sliced apple room are the same skill sets you would need to work on a line at Barilla, at La Destri, at Seneca Foods. And again, this is where I'm always going to be, you know, the Food Link cheerleader on this, not just the fellowship here, because we are in a unique position to do that. Those are all of our partners. Those are our food donors. So they're in our facility on a regular basis anyways, providing us with whatever surplus they have. And now they get to see what it's like for someone like Rudy to spend a year with us and really develop the skills to go work at those places. I'd also like, if you don't mind, Jess, could you explain also the four different terms within the curriculum? Because what Rudy's doing today is certainly not what she's going to be doing in 6 months.
No, definitely. So the first quarter are the fundamentals, and that's where folks start to work with the Ruby curriculum. They start the basics in the kitchen, and they build from there each quarter. The second quarter, fellows actually become employees of Food Link and work full-time for us and build their skills and get a little bit more responsibility in the kitchen. The third quarter, they have an internship at Food Link and select either that food manufacturing that Mitch was talking about, our warehouse area, or the kitchen. And really have full-on the-job training. And then the last quarter is an externship at a community partner, and we have the opportunity to have all of our current fellows have their externship at Wegmans. So they'll leave the safety of Food Link, where they've grown comfortable, and get to have a different mentor and a different on-the-job experience.
I want to ask John Emerson a question about small and large batch, because you talk about large batch cooking. And forgive me, take me back through where you really learned to cook, whether it was growing up, school, et cetera. Mm.
So the first restaurant I worked in, I was 12 years old. Started as a dishwasher and watching the cooks and always wanting to be one of those folks.
Where was that?
Toronto, Canada. Uh-huh. A little place called Archibald's. So back in those days, we were scrubbing out the escargot shells and things like that for a living as dishwashers and kitchen helpers, chasing lobsters and all kinds of things. My brother and I worked in the same restaurant. A lot of great memories. I learned a lot of small batch cooking working in small restaurants. Then when I did my apprenticeship, which was 6,000 hours, 3 years and 2 semesters of school in Toronto, I went to work at the Harbor Castle, which is a big 1,000-room hotel. So we had a couple hundred cooks in that kitchen, and that's where I really learned to cook for 3,000 people in one dinner. Or I think we could do 6,000 people per meal period in the hotel. So
yeah.
All of a sudden, turning a potato, which is a specific shape like a barrel, you were doing that for 6 hours. Or any job you were doing when you were boning chicken, you were doing 1,000 chicken.
Right.
And that really helped build the skills. And then I went, you know, kind of smaller in the size of the operation, but much more upscale. And I went to work for a hotel just outside of Zurich in Switzerland. And from there, I went to Ritz-Carlton hotels. So there's a progression, but it all started with learning those skills so well that I could do them with my eyes closed. I could do it the same way every time, always done on time. And that came from the large quantity experience. I really think that doing things in volume helped. You know, it's like anything, it's muscle memory. I'm a golfer as well. So it's like that. The more shots you hit, you don't need to think about it as much. It just becomes intuitive. And I think it's the same way in skills development, that repetition, especially if there's a conscious effort to try and get better at it, that leads to great things and can really enable you to get more opportunities once you're on the job.
And so I wonder if you think, is it a fallacy that when you scale up, you can't, I'm not sure anybody can maintain quality if you're cooking for a dozen versus 1,200, but is it a fallacy that at some level you can't maintain quality? It's got to be sort of mass-produced, simple, simplified, et cetera. How do you view that kind of progression?
Certainly I can do a much better job cooking for the five of us
than
I could for 500 of us. But, you know, there's an industry that's designed around cooking for large quantities of people, and they do their job extremely well. Both have levels of excellence to be attained, whether you're cooking for a small quantity in a private dining room or in your house, or cooking for a convention. Both can be done well. Some things just aren't possible when you have 5,000 people in the room.
Yeah, I mean, like we had Mark Cupolo from Rocco on a couple weeks ago. And Mark, if you're listening, look, you do a great job, man, but your restaurant's small. You know? so big deal. No, I'm kidding. I mean, obviously, Mark does a great job and the staff there does a great job. John, what's the largest number that you've had to prepare food for? Do you know offhand?
Let me say I love Rocco.
I live
just two blocks from there and love the place. The largest quantity, we've done some street festivals for 21,000 before.
21,000.
Well, I was also at Ground Zero feeding the relief workers, Wegman sponsored along with our partner David Boulay in New York City. And we were feeding tens of thousands of people every day.
That's great.
And we were feeding them some great food. And they needed all the help they could get. And that's what we were able to do.
I'm sure you were very proud of that, too.
The other thing I would add is that institutional food service is a thing that exists, and a lot of our community relies on it. The food that we produce, the 5,000 meals a day, are all part of the federal child and adult care feeding program. So any kid who goes to RCSD is categorically eligible for a free lunch, or actually a free breakfast, a free lunch, and also a free after-school meal. Someone's got to produce those meals. And what we've been arguing, especially since we moved our kitchen into our new facility, is that we shouldn't just give up on the opportunity to improve the quality of those meals. Unfortunately, far too often, institutional food providers are taking frozen chicken nuggets, they're taking a fruit cocktail and syrup, and they're putting that on the tray and saying, this is the meal. We have a chance to do better. That's why Wegmans helped us design the kitchen. And that's why we hired our first ever executive chef, who many in this community and some of your listeners know. It's Chef Casey Hollenbeck, who used to run Mise en Place, among other places. And so we're really bringing a higher level of quality to our kitchen than ever before. And it's imperative for us to have the fellows be part of this process.
It's almost like Mitch is reading ahead of my script, because in our second half hour, one of the things we're going to talk about is, I would still bet, if you're someone who goes through the line at Wegmans occasionally and they said, would you like to donate a dollar to Foodlink, or you've done that, maybe your thought of Foodlink is somewhat limited about a food bank, and a food bank has sort of this kind of narrow scope of an idea in the imagination of most people who don't work there or go there. But in our second half hour, we're going to talk about how that mission has expanded. You're not the only one to blame for that, probably. I probably blame you for a lot of it. We'll talk about a little bit. Yeah. So we'll talk about how that mission of food banks has expanded. And I'm curious to know if that's also happening around the country. So in our second half hour, we're going to get there. So before we get our first break here, John, I wonder if the Rudies of the world, your fellows, are going to learn as they cook in larger batches, when they're going to run their own places eventually or cook in different places, they got to answer these questions. So if you're cooking for 50, 100, or 1,000 people, what's the easiest meal to prepare at a high quality in a big quantity?
It's all easy with the skills, Evan.
Okay.
it really is. There's so many different skills, whether you're roasting, grilling, poaching, simmering, frying, sautéing.
But you're not doing 1,000 cassoulets, you know?
You can.
You could. Okay.
Yeah, absolutely.
John,
you can.
You can. Eventually, Rudy can. But there's not a go-to, at a larger scale if you're cooking for a big group?
I think if you go to a large hospital, they're cooking for a lot of people every day. If you go to a large Ritz-Carlton or a Four Seasons or a Shangri-La hotel or a Hyatt, they're cooking for a lot of people every day. There's skills, equipment, and foods that can be done at every level. It's a matter of feasibility and practicality based on who you're serving and what they're paying and the skill level of your team. And that's really the important point. We're only limited by the skill level of our team in what food we can produce, how high quality it can be. Things can be very fine. I'm happy to say that we have experiences for people to learn that finer level of detail cooking for small quantity too. At Wegmans, we have our Amore restaurant on East Avenue.
Yep.
We have Next Door Bar and Grill on Monroe Avenue. And we cook for small parties. We do special small catering through our stores. We have a great variety of experiences for people, and so do some of the other partners and stakeholders around the table working on this program with FoodLink.
All right, that's John Emerson telling us the story of what a lot of these students, these fellows, are learning. So John's the chef and vice president of restaurant foods at Wegmans Food Markets. Jess Scannell-Rooks is here, director of career empowerment initiatives at FoodLink. And Mitch Gruber, chief programs officer at FoodLink, also a member of Rochester City Council. And LaRonda Rudy Harris is a member of this inaugural class as we talk about what FoodLink is doing and the ways that they are trying to bring more people into middle skills jobs here in the industry. A lot of different opportunities, and they're expanding those opportunities. So it's a great conversation. Let's get that only break for the hour and come right back here on the Summer of Food on Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Friday on The Next Connections, Reverend Prince Singh is the Bishop of the Episcopal Diocese of Rochester. He's got a lot to say about current divisions within our country and racism in our community. We'll talk about what he's learned and the role he thinks the church can play in healing those divides. In our second hour, we're joined by members of the Landmark Society and LGBTQ leaders to talk about landmarks in our community that have played a pivotal role in the LGBTQ movement. Talk with you Friday. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. We're talking about the FoodLink Career Fellowship here on the Summer of Food, and they can't do that without a little resources, and we're less than 2 months away. I actually thought we were 2 months to the day away, but it's already July 19th. September 17th is FoodLink's upcoming Festival of Food. Is that correct?
That's right.
You still do it at the public market?
It's going to be a great event. It's the best food event of the year.
And so if you're going to mark your calendar, September 17th, Mitch, if they haven't been there, what's going on September 17th at the public market?
We have well over 100 different restaurants, food vendors, breweries, wineries, you name it. You do something interesting with food, you're going to be a vendor there. And whatever the ticket costs, don't quote me on this because I don't really know, you go and it's all you can eat, all you can drink. You have a great time at the public market.
All right.
You also get an opportunity to meet Rudy because the fellows will be serving up some delicious food.
That's cool. Awesome. So they've got less than 2 months to be ready to do that. That's great. September 17th, if you want to do that. We're talking about the FoodLink Career Fellowship, and you may be hearing about these 12 fellows as part of this, the rollout of this Career Fellowship program, and wonder, well, what about me or someone I know? So I'd love the folks from FoodLink to tell us how people like Rudy get hooked up with this. Jess?
Sure. So it was not an open enrollment for this program. We specifically work with community-based organizations, partner organizations of FoodLink, and individuals have to be nominated to participate in the program. So maybe a case manager or a colleague would nominate them. Folks apply. Then they have a panel interview at FoodLink, and then they have a 2-to-3-shift job shadow. So they actually come in and work at FoodLink, and they get to see what we're all about, and we get to see what they're all about. And then we go through an intake screening process, and folks go to WorkFit for drug testing and a physical, and then they're offered a fellowship spot. We had 29 nominations this time, 16 folks who completed the entire application process, and 12 who were selected.
Yeah, it could only take 12. And Rudy, you were nominated for the program by your case manager at Sojourner House, is that right?
Yes.
So how do you remember hearing about this for the first time? Did she tell you?
She actually called me and she told me about... Oh, I'm sorry.
That's okay. Get right on that mic for me.
She actually called me and she told me about it. So she asked me, did I want to do it? I said, yeah. It was a great opportunity, so I'm like, why not?
And what was the process like of doing the shadowing? You know, what did you see?
It was good. Because the first day I went, what did we do? He just basically had us like stirring up food in the that he already mixed up. So he told me if I would have came earlier, I would have got the whole hint to everything. But it was great.
Looked like something you wanted to do.
Yeah, because it was great.
But you know, not everyone can be selected. What was it like finding out that you were going to do it?
I was happy. You know, I was real happy. Like, because I didn't want to pass up this opportunity.
Jess, what do you do to make sure anybody who's got any transportation help? I mean, what do you do to make sure that all those barriers are taken down?
So that's one of the reasons why we have community-based partners refer people, because we know that we can't do this all on our own. Folks get bus passes for the first quarter. That's unpaid. And then, you know, one of the things that separates this program from other job training programs is that we pay our fellows for the other 9 months that they're with us. We work with folks on individual barriers. We identify them early on and then work with our community partners and our fellows to make sure that they don't hold our folks back.
I remember we started having meetings about this probably with John. I recall the first meeting feels like it must have been 3 or 4 years ago. And we sat around the table and started talking about this. And John's point has been crystal clear all along. This is about giving people consistent routines, right? Debone the chicken 1,000 times. The problem is most programs in this community and elsewhere are, let's call them 10 to 20 weeks, something in that range. And you just can't debone 1,000 chickens in that amount of time. The issue then became, if we want this to be a year-long program, or as John initially wanted, a two-year program, the problem is what every single community partner said around the table, how on earth will you keep people if you're not paying them? And it's true. We can't ask folks who are otherwise having a hard time finding a job, we can't ask them to volunteer their time for a year. So that's what makes this program incredibly unique. There is actually nothing like it across the country. Jess and I know, we've done the research. There's nothing like it.
You've tried to find like another model?
Exactly. Yeah. There is a consortium of community kitchens out there. And when they came and consulted with us, they said, you're nuts. Don't do a year-long program. But the key to this, the reason it's going to work is because we have industry partners like Wegmans who are ready to help provide externships, who are eager to place people into jobs. And we have really generous and bold private foundations who are willing to fund essentially creating these jobs. So right now, Rudy and her colleagues are in a situation where for the first 3 months, they are just like in any other job training program. They're volunteers. They're learning how this works. But assuming they are on the right track at the end of 3 months, they become paid employees. They are earning wages. And that's really going to help ensure that we have a high retention rate throughout the program.
That's great stuff. I've got an email from Rick who says, Evan, as I listen to your guests during this second hour, the repeated mention of the need for practice reminds me of the Jim Collins article, What It Takes to Be Great. Turns out 10,000 hours of deliberate practice is required, no matter what you are trying to learn. One of your guests certainly talked about this language without specifically referring to the Collins article. So maybe deboning a chicken 1,000 times, or you know, the whole 10,000 hours to be an expert, which I thought was a Malcolm Gladwell thing. That might it be just that he was referring to somebody else doing it? I don't know, but regardless, the point of repetition, what Mitch and John have really been driving is that repetition, because in a year, after, again, 3 months, they become paid employees, 9 months later, at least there are certain things, John, that they can do a lot more efficiently than they can do right now, right?
Absolutely. And it turns on a positive cycle as well. When you try to learn how to do something, and you get better at it, you feel successful. And you become addicted to that. And you want to learn and get even better. And as you build up increases in your proficiency and successes, and you work in a great environment where people acknowledge that and call out and congratulate you for growing, I believe we all become addicted to that. And we want to do more of it. And it spurs us on to do more. You know, instant gratification, really.
And Elizabeth on Twitter is asking, I missed the beginning of this show. How is this awesome program funded? Are donations accepted via Foodlink NY?
Donations are certainly accepted.
By the way, Elizabeth is not like a plant who works for Foodlink. She's a pediatrician. That's a genuine question.
Appreciate that. Foodlinkny.org is always a place to go. But I will, again, give a shout out to the three really honestly very bold foundations that that funded this, which is the Konar Foundation, the ESL Foundation, and the McGowan Foundation, all of whom really took a chance and were willing to fund a program that was really just an idea. Jess and I did do a ton of research trying to figure out what else is working. We went to DC, LA, Orlando, a lot of different places to make sure that we were taking best practices from the, from those communities. But ultimately, these funders trusted us. And I'm very confident they did so because we had people like John at the table saying this is needed in our community. And before I forget, I just want to mention, I was sent with some statistics today, which I already forgot, but ONET, which I think does a lot of the job growth projections, is projecting that from 2016 to 2026, there's going to be a 10 to 14% growth in chefs and head cooks. And there's going to be a 2% decline in fast food operators as that stuff becomes automated.
Yeah, yeah.
The fact is, we need people who are going to be in the food industry to learn the middle skills. They have to learn how to debone chickens, not throw frozen fries into a fryer. And this program is really unique in its ability to do that.
Well, you know, Rudy, when you are done with this program, you know, you talked about looking down the line, maybe owning your own restaurant at some point, but that can't be right away. So what's first job? What do you think would be a great way, and get right on that mic and tell me what you think you'd love to do first? Have you thought about that?
No, I didn't think about it.
That's still too far down the road for you?
Yeah.
And if you were hosting a group of people over, what is something you would love to cook for somebody?
I just make what I like to cook is rice and chicken.
Mm-hmm.
So I'll make some of that, and then I have like some, what is they called?
So you start with rice and chicken.
What's for dessert?
I'll make some, maybe some banana pudding, and I don't know.
No.
Oh, I'll make some tacos also.
Okay. See, everybody's got a go-to. Everybody's got like a default, someone's coming over.
Because you can make tacos any type of way.
Yeah. And I wonder, John, do you think, how much have you thought about extending opportunities for these middle school skill positions to people who might not have opportunities, to people who have struggled more than someone like me? I mean, like I've said this many times in the program. I grew up in an upper, you know, middle-class home. Life has never really been a grind for me. That's just the reality. I wonder if there's more creativity in people who have struggled. I'm curious about that. Have you thought about that?
I think there's more appreciation sometimes for opportunities. The whole idea of this program was to nourish a community that Food Link was already nourishing. But, you know, to get upstream and nourish people with great careers and opportunity and successes. I myself went through an apprenticeship, as I said, and I didn't come from a lot of means at the beginning, and it meant everything in the world to me to get that opportunity, and I try not to take anything for granted ever since.
Absolutely.
But there's a real satisfaction to mastering those skills and the different levels, and you know it starts with cooking skills, but maybe then it turns to supervisory skills or designing skills, and it's just rungs on the ladder, and you just keep on climbing, and I think there's not always the whole population that appreciates opportunity and sees things as an opportunity. You know, we talk about sense of entitlement and things like that. So,
right,
and this is great.
I'm not sure that I can comment on the creativity that you know.
So, are you not that creative a chef yourself?
I'm a creative eater. I'll eat anything, but I'm not a very creative chef. But I think what Jess can probably comment on better than me is that the folks we're working with have this incredible hunger for this type of work. People like Rudy are so excited about the opportunity to learn, and not just learn, but actually be paid and start to have a job that gives them an opportunity to cook every day. Do you want to talk about some of our other partners, at who's around the table, and some of the hunger we've seen?
Well, I mean, I want to talk about the fellows and what they've already demonstrated is, you know, John talks about folks who are excited about an opportunity. But what I've already seen demonstrated is, you know, folks that are coming into our program have a resilience that you don't always find. They, like Mitch said, are hungry for opportunities. They're hungry to learn. they soak up everything. They walk around the kitchen with those little notepads and their pens, and they're writing notes and experimenting, and also an empathy and a humility. And that's what we've already seen demonstrated in the kitchen. This team has congealed fairly quickly. And I think, Rudy, you told me walking in, you wouldn't have kept coming to the program if you didn't get that sense of community and teamwork from the folks involved. So I think that that's something that we're already seeing.
That's just awesome to hear about a team coming together and knowing that that door is open when it might not have otherwise been open. We've really enjoyed having this conversation. And if you're the kind of person who hears FoodLink and you're still thinking, you know, food bank, food cupboard, food pantry, all the things that people think in a narrow sense, are food banks changing, Mitch, or is FoodLink changing? I'm wondering if that's sort of reflective of what's going on. And can you kind of illustrate a little bit of how that change has happened over the years?
Yeah, I mean, with FoodLink is a consistently evolving organization.
I mean, like, what is it? When you do the elevator pitch and you're in another city and someone goes, oh, yeah, what do you do? What is FoodLink?
I press stop on the elevator, so I have at least 45 minutes to tell the whole story.
You'd be insufferable. I would hate being on an elevator.
Yeah, really. I agree. You probably would. The honest truth is that our culture has always been one of consistent growth and transformation. Tom Ferraro started in 1978, and I don't think ever intended to start a traditional food bank. A lot of our partners across the country, however, have done just that. And for them, it's a matter of serving charitable food. We still do that. We distribute about 18, 19 million pounds of food every year. And I don't want to minimize the importance of that. That is the reason why we have relationships with Wegmans, who is a key donor. Things that are unsaleable to Wegmans comes to us. It also gives us a chance to create incredible partnerships like with Sojourner House, where Rudy came from, and Pathstone, which is, you know, their umbrella organization. So it allows us to be incredibly collaborative. But it has become very clear in my 10 years of working at FoodLink that you cannot solve hunger by feeding it, that you have to figure out how to look at some of the root causes of hunger. And hunger is not some type of strange physical problem in and of itself. It is the issue of poverty.
Yeah, I mean, when you say you can't solve hunger by feeding it, that people might be like, "What?" But I think you're saying is, if people are hungry, yes, you have to feed them. But just feeding them doesn't change the underlying circumstances that created that hunger.
That's right. And they'll be hungry again tomorrow.
Yeah.
So we do feed them. That's why we distribute 18 million pounds of food a year. That's why we produce 5,000 hot meals a day in our kitchen. But in reality, what we want is for people to stop coming to those lines. And so that's why, I mean, I've been on your show countless times talking about things like the curbside market, our urban agriculture opportunities, our cooking classes in the community itself. And those things all really help, but nothing has given us the opportunity to make a deeper impact on people's lives than this fellowship program. And I'm really excited to see where it goes in the next 12 months and beyond. But I'll tell you, it is part of a larger transformation, I think, in food banks across the country, but certainly here, where forever we focus on indirect service, right? We serve the settlement houses who serves the individuals at the food pantry. But we are doing more direct service now. So you see it at our curbside market. Go to the public market every Thursday and Saturday. You'll see our educators out there teaching people how to cook when on a budget. But this fellowship is a chance to really engage with 12 individuals in a very, very deep level, to have Jess usher them through this program, but also to link them up with employers like Wegmans and educators like MCC that want to offer them multiple career opportunities. Where is the right pathway for Rudy? It certainly won't be the same as all 11 other fellows. And we've developed the relationships to give people multiple platforms.
And what is it going to take, John, to create a region where we don't have this big gap in available, skilled, middle-skill workers and the jobs that are there? I mean, are we on the way? Are we even close?
I think we are, if we can consolidate efforts around one thing long enough as a city, as a society, to create real achievement. We are the Napa Valley of the East here. You look at the wine industry, the farming industry, now the microbrew industry, the food manufacturing business. This is all a great part of growing the economy in upstate New York, and that economy needs to float all boats. So we want to get more people involved in it and help build a bigger industry. And there's a place for all of us in that industry. And let's be proud of the great bountiful food that we have here in the upstate New York area.
Mitch, if FoodLink is ultimately successful, eventually there will not need to be a FoodLink. Is that true?
Well, we won't need to have a food bank. I mean, the beautiful thing about what we've done is we've diversified our work so much that we have opportunities to impact the community in a multitude of ways. What I tell anyone walking through our facility is that if you're working on something about community health or wellness and it involves food, we're going to be there and we're going to be helpful. We would love to continue to see the 18 million pounds of food a year that we distribute go down through emergency channels. But I don't want to see the curbside market shrink until another retailer is ready to take it over. Yeah, I don't want to see our fellowship shrink until another institution is taking that over. We want to keep growing not just the food economy, but also the charitable sector.
And let's just be realistic. I mean, right now we are many, many years away from any of the branches of FoodLink not being needed. I mean, that need is there. And that's why we've been telling you about the FoodLink Career Fellowship Program. And Rudy, good luck to you. I hope you enjoy it. And I hope we talk in a year and in 5 years and in 10. And it's just this evolution of what you're doing in the food industry. And it's going to be so much fun. Thank you for being here.
You're welcome. Thank you.
All right. Thanks to Jess as well. Good luck with the program. We'll talk again. Thank you, Jess.
Thanks.
Mitch Gruber, I know I'll see you around the various places in Rochester as part of City Council and the Chief Programs Officer at FoodLink. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you. Festival of Food, September 17th, foodlinkny.org.
And John Emerson with Wegmans. Thank you, John. Great fun this hour. Our thanks to Rob Braden, engineer, Megan Mack, producer. I'm Evan Dawson. Talk with you Friday.